Please to Psalm 2. You know, it's amazing, and I'm sure many of you saw the news this afternoon, that there are at least three, perhaps more, police officers killed down in Baton Rouge. Especially after we studied about that this morning, it doesn't just remind you how evil this world is. It just blew my mind. Someone had gotten an update on their phone and had mentioned it to me. Then when I went back and read the story and just see just the evil that's involved, doesn't it make you thankful for God's people? Doesn't it make you thankful that you can come here with people who want to serve the Lord, who want to be on the side of good, who want to fight against the forces of Satan and do what's right? And I am so thankful for each and every one of you here this evening. This evening, what I'd like to do, and I prepared this before the events that occurred this afternoon, is I want to go through Psalm 2 together. Psalm 2. I changed my sermon on Friday after some events in the news. And I'm sure that many of you saw over the weekend that there was a tragedy in France. And Jessica and I were home, and I had been scrolling through social media and saw an update about it, and we turned the news on and watched it and saw what had happened. But from what current news I've been able to find, there are currently 84 killed by a terrorist attack. 84 people killed. And I don't know if you've looked at the images. The news media on the television did not show many of them, but many of them are heartbreaking. The ones with the children, I can't even, for your sake, I'm not going to talk about. But a few that I saw with children who'd been killed by this madman, it's just sickening. Sickening. But one observation Jessica and I made about this was a few months ago when there was another terrorist attack in France, it was all that anyone talked about. You know, whenever I was at family gatherings, church settings, anything, that's all that people talked about. Everyone on Facebook changed their profile pic to have the French flag in the background. There was many stories about people who'd been to France, various pictures I saw from France. But what was interesting was as Jessica and I sat there and watched this, I counted dozens of, and I'm not meaning this as a joke, but I counted dozens of posts about Pokemon, various ones about who the potential vice president candidate was going to be for Trump. This was on Thursday night, whenever we saw this. And I saw one post about France. And then the next day, when my family got together, we went down and saw some of my family on Friday, nobody was really talking about it. You know, we were talking about Mike Pence and was he or was he not going to be Trump's VP, and we were talking about life, and I remember the last time that this had happened in France, it was just all we talked about. And I started to wonder, have we become so callous to the evils of this world that it doesn't even faze us anymore when 84 people are murdered by a terrorist and the images are just tragic? And the question I want to answer tonight is this: what can we learn about this tragedy from Psalm 2? I, to my knowledge, have not preached a sermon or given a lesson just on the Psalms, but the Psalms are really, to me, the heart of the Bible. And I'm not saying they're the core, but they're the heart. They're the heart of the Bible. If you want to see the emotion, in the just the raw emotion that's in the Scripture, you go to the Psalms. And there's many psalms that are very special to me and that I read in times of tragedy and difficulty. But Psalm 2 is one that I go back when there are such national tragedies as this. So what I want to do tonight is just study through Psalm 2 together and try to see what implications it can have for what's going on in the world. So let's just read through it together. Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs, and the Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, the end of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore, O kings, be wise, be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and perish in the way. For his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. It's a fairly short psalm, but there's a lot of depth here that I think can bring a lot of the events that we see in the world to light. Now, as we look at Psalm 2, the basic theme of Psalm 2 is that the Lord reigns. This is, I think, the message that we're going to see throughout the psalm, is that the Lord is the one who reigns, God is king, and the earth is going to bow to him. And the outline that I would offer is pretty simple. I see four major sections to this. The first section comes in verses 1 through 3. In verses 1 through 3, David, who we're going to see as the author, Acts 4 tells us that, David writes that, first of all, the nations rage. So the nations rage and plot and scheme against God. And then while the nations are raging, the Lord reigns. And that's what 4 through 6 is going to tell us. 4 through 6 is going to show us that while the nations rage and plot and scheme, God himself reigns and he's above all this. And then we go through 7 through 9, and it focuses there on the Lord's rod. And we're going to see that God himself is going to bring all these nations into judgment, and he is going to be the one with his rod of iron, break them and judge them. And then goes back and finally talks about the nations then are going to have a choice to take refuge in the God of heaven or perish. So that's the basic outline that I see of the book. Now, of the chapter rather. What's interesting to note about this is you'll notice there's like a bookend here. The first three verses talk about the nations, and the last three verses likewise talk about the nations. In between's all about God. And what I think we're going to see is really interesting is this, that he's talking about events that are going on. He then shows how God answers and makes sense of these events that are going on, and then sees these events in a new light based on God's justice and based on his nature. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at how the nations rage, we're going to look at how the Lord reigns, we're going to look at the Lord's rod, and then finally look at the nation's refuge. So let's go through verses 1 through 3. All about the nations rage together. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. So what we see in the first three verses is that the nations are raging together. And let's just look through the logic of this. He asks a rhetorical question in the first verse. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? And he's telling us here in verse 2 what they're plotting about. The kings and the rulers are plotting against the Lord and against his anointed. We'll see who that is. Saying, let us burst the bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. So essentially what he's saying here is the nations are plotting and scheming against God. Why do they do this? Why do the nations plot and scheme against God? Well, first of all, as we look at the context of this, it's interesting to note, typically in the Psalms, most Psalms tell us who the author is. So if you look at Psalm 3, I want you to note one thing in your scripture with me. Psalm 3, at the very beginning of it, in all caps, it says, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. That's a part of the original psalm. The psalmist had originally recorded that with it. It's part of the original. Probably above in bold or italics, you have something like, save me, O God. That's been put in there by the scribes and translators. But that part below it was originally a part of the psalm. Psalm 1 and 2 are typically thought to be written together. Psalm 1 focuses on the individual man. Psalm 2 focuses on nations. Psalm 2 does not have that first introductory note telling us who wrote it. But if we look at Acts 4, we won't take the time to turn there. But if we look at Acts 4, it defines there through the inspiration of the Spirit. David did write this. So David, I think, is king at this point. And David, the great psalmist, is the anointed king of Israel. And he's asking the question then, why are all the nations around us plotting and scheming against God and against his anointed? Verse 2, it says, why are they plotting and taking counsel against Yahweh, the Lord, and against the anointed? Who's his anointed? Well, a couple other psalms, I think, help us to understand who the anointed is. Let's just look at Psalm 18 together. Psalm 18, we see in Psalm 18, this is written by David, verse 50. Psalm 18, 50. Great salvation he brings to his king and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. So here we see God brings salvation to the king. This is, at some point we'll go through and talk about how to study the Psalms. This is called complementary parallelism. Let me just tell you what that means. There's a thought expressed in one part, and then it amplifies it in the second. Essentially just says the same thing in a few different words. So he says, great salvation he brings to his king and shows steadfast love to his anointed. The king's the anointed one, David. David, who's the anointed one, is. So in Psalm 2, when he asked the question, why do the kings of the earth plot against the Lord? Why ultimately do they plot against the Lord and against me? Why do they plot against the king? Why do they plot against the king of Israel? So the question that he looks at and tries to answer is this: the nations plot together to overthrow David and ultimately God. Now, as you go through 2 Samuel, 1 Samuel records for us the rise of David. It shows us by the end. Saul is still king by the end. David's been anointed, I believe, in 1 Samuel 16. And when we look to see his anointing that he'd received by Saul, he didn't really become the reigning king of Judah and Israel for a long time later. But when you get to 2 Samuel, 2 Samuel records for us all the history of David. In the history of David, while he was a man after God's own heart, it is a utterly conflictual kingship. I mean, the nations plot to overthrow him. His son plots to overthrow him. His family wants to overthrow him. The Philistines want to overthrow him. I mean, it's just the story of David. And I think he's probably talking especially about the Philistines in this case and other minor nations as well. But why have I been anointed king of the chosen people of Israel, the chosen nation? Out of all the nations of the earth, I have been anointed the king of these people, and yet they are plotting against me. Now, brethren, I think we recognize David lived about 1,000 BC. So this is about 3,000 years later. Not a lot's changed, has it? I mean, it's sad, but not a lot's changed. The nations still plot. How do we overthrow the jurisdiction of the God of heaven? How do we make our own morality? How do we live by our own standards? In the type of plotting and raging, I mean, especially when you consider verse 1. Why do the nations rage together? You may have another translation there. It calls that a noisy assembly. Essentially, it's asking, why do they all come together and try to plot together to overthrow God? And brethren, isn't this the question we ask so often? Why do the evil peoples of the world plot together to kill the innocent? Why? I mean, you look at the terrorist organizations. What happened in, let me get my French correctly, Nice, France? Is that correct? Nice, France, I believe it is. What happened there on Thursday night? During French Independence Day. Not a coincidence at all. What was the motivation behind that? Pure evil. The killings we see this afternoon, pure evil. Killings out in Dallas, pure evil. Killings we saw in France a couple months ago, pure evil. Why do the nations rage? Why? Well, what he's going to do, he's going to contrast this with verses 4-6. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So you'll notice what the nations are doing. The nations, I mean, you get this image in your head that, you know, the great kings are coming together and they're plotting and they're taking counsel and they're trying to scheme and find a way to overthrow God, to overthrow David, to overthrow the anointed. And as they plot and scheme and go through the best military tactics and the best knowledge that they can, God laughs. He who sits in the heaven laughs. And the Lord holds them in derision. God just laughs at this. You puny kings think you can overthrow my king? Look, I may have anointed a little shepherd boy with a slingshot, but I have anointed him through Samuel, and I have chosen him to be the king of my people. And you nations have the gall to think that you are going to overthrow my king? It's laughable. Because ultimately God knows what their end is going to be. If we look at Psalm 37, a similar verse, a complimentary verse, we see in Psalm 37, verse 13, the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. The Lord knows the end of the wicked. The Lord knows, because of his omnipotence and his omniscience, that the Philistines are going to perish, that the Canaanites perished, that Absalom will perish, and that all the nations who plotted against David have perished. And as much as you may try to overthrow my nation, I think the irony of this is, they plot to overthrow Israel. Ultimately, God's going to be the one to overthrow Israel. No one but God himself can overthrow his nation. And while they plot and scheme, God knows where they're going. Because God is going to be the one in verse 5 to speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury. And the Lord is going to be the one who exercises judgment. We won't take the time to turn there, but if you look in Revelation 6, verse 16 and 17, it's a very similar image used. I think that John in this case is drawing from Psalm 2 to recognize here that God is going to be the one to exercise judgment. Judgment belongs with God. And brethren, that's a principle that really goes throughout the Psalms. Judgment lies with God. If you read through the Psalms, some of the imprecatory Psalms, an imprecatory Psalm, and there's a bunch of them, is a Psalm where the psalmist wants essentially judgment to be brought against an enemy. That's all an imprecation is, that judgment be brought against an enemy. As you go throughout these Psalms, over and over again, the petition is, God, you, let your will be done. You judge them. Let your judgment be done against these people. And this is what David's asking here as well. David, while he's expressing his frustration at the nations, he's saying, I'm not going to be the one to overthrow you, but God is going to be the one to overthrow you, because God is going to be the one who, even perhaps after I'm dead, he will exercise wrath on you. But, verse 6, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So what David has done is David has set God, his king, on Zion. You'll notice here our God's referred to. Let's contrast this a little bit. Verse 2, the kings of the earth, the rulers, the anointed. Verse 6, I have set my king, capital K there probably in your translation, my king on Zion, my holy hill. This was God's holy hill. If you look at 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 7, and Psalm 110 as well. Psalm 110 is the most messianic psalm of all of them. God here is seen to be the one on Zion, on the holy hill. So what he's saying here is, I am going to turn my eyes away from all of the nations. I'm not going to worry about what all the other nations are doing. I'm going to look to God. I'm going to look to his holy hill. I'm going to look to Zion, where I know God is. And so as David then recognizes, first, the nations are raging. Second, the Lord is reigning. He's also going to recognize the Lord's rod will bring judgment. Verse 7, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son, today I've begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now, this is where the psalm takes a messianic twist. Psalm 2 is a psalm that's quoted about 5 times in the New Testament as being reference to Christ. And so as you look at verse 7, when it says here, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. In the immediate context, this is talking about David. Ultimately, the New Testament is going to apply this to refer to Jesus, to where God the Father has said, Christ, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. And as you look throughout this, I have a bunch of verses up here that we won't take the time to turn to, but you can write them down as reference. This is the messianic twist of the psalm. Acts 13, Hebrews 1, Hebrews 5, I'll quote this, along with God himself says this at the baptism of Jesus in Matthew 3, and then at the transfiguration in Matthew 17. This idea here, that you are my son, did I have begotten you? It's quoted various times in the New Testament referencing Christ. So here, on this side of Christ, this side of the cross, I think we understand a little bit better what this verse is saying. David says, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ultimately, what we recognize this side of the cross is Jesus is the anointed. Jesus is the king. Jesus is the son. And so while David is going to tell the decree that I am the one who's been anointed, I am your son, ultimately, this is in reference to Christ. What's interesting as you go into verse 8, let's notice who's talking in verse 8. The Lord said to me, this is going to be Yahweh, the God of heaven, speaking, verse 7 through 9. God says, verse 7, you are my son, today I've begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of the earth your possession. So first, verse 8, David, ask me. All you have to do is ask me, and I'm going to give you the nations. Ask me, and I will make the ends of the earth your possession. And that's one reason David is going to stretch the rule of Israel far greater than Saul did, because David is going to trust in God, in the providence of God to stretch the nation. God is telling David, David, trust me, and I will stretch the nations. I will make them your heritage, the ends of the earth your possession. But let's notice the contrast in verse 9. Once they're yours, you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Do y'all see anything a bit ironic about those two verses? Verse 8. Ask of me, I will make the nations your heritage, the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Okay, Randy, you know how much I love Christmas. And I have this one Christmas ball that's just beautiful, okay? It goes back in the family 3 generations. I want you to have the ball, and then I want you to break it with a rod of iron and dash it in pieces like a potter's vessel. What? You're telling me I don't get to rule over these nations? You're telling me I don't get to keep the ornament? You're telling me I don't get to keep the nations? What God's telling him here is, David, I'm going to give you the nations, but you shall be the one who's going to exercise judgment. These are not the nations for you to just to revel in, but these are the nations that you are going to bring judgment against. Remember, David had said just a few verses earlier that God will terrify them in his fury. God is then telling David, David, you're going to be the one to break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. God is going to exercise judgment through David. And what's interesting, if you look at this idea of the rod of iron, again, I have multiple verses up here as reference. Revelation uses this idea at least 3 times of a rod. And I do want us to look at the one in Jeremiah 19. Jeremiah 19 is very similar. But I want us to notice the outcome of this rod in Jeremiah 19. Jeremiah lived about, let me think through this. Jeremiah would have lived, David was about 1,000, and Jeremiah would have lived about 500 years after David. And we read in Jeremiah 19, verse 11. Jeremiah 19, let's start in verse 10. You shall break them. Break the flask in the sight of the men who go to you, and you'll say to them, thus says the Lord of hosts, shall I break the people of this city as one breaks a potter's vessel so that it can never be mended? What is the outcome of breaking? What is the outcome of the rod? Ultimately, so that it can never be mended. And I think this is the same implication back in Psalm 2. Back in Psalm 2, what God is saying here, David, you're going to break the nation so that they can never be mended again. I mean, you have here a pot, and when that pot breaks, you're not going to get super glue and put it back together. Randy, you're not going to take my ornament and get duct tape and put it back together. You're not mending it. You're taking the rod and you're going to break them. You're going to exercise judgments against them. And so in light of this, the nations are then given a choice. Are they going to take refuge in God, or are they going to flee from him? Verse 10, now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. Now, he tells first of all in verse 10, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Y'all notice the contrast that that's making earlier in the psalm with verse 2? The kings of the earth set themselves, the rulers take counsel. Same idea here. Verse 2, the kings are setting themselves, the rulers are taking counsel against the Lord. And then he tells them, verse 10, O kings, be wise. O rulers of the earth, be warned. Because, verse 11, serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Stop your plotting, stop your scheming, stop your conniving, stop your rebellion against the God of heaven, and serve him with fear and rejoice with trembling. Serve him and take refuge in him, and he will spare you, or he will break you through me with a rod of iron. There's further messianic fulfillment in verse 12. And you look at verse 12, kiss the Son. John 5, and I do want to turn there. John 5, a similar idea is used in John chapter 5 and verse 23. John chapter 5 and verse 23. Of Jesus it says, starting verse 22. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that they may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. God the Father has given judgment to the Son, so that then, verse 23, they may honor the Son. This is the same idea back in Psalm 2:12. That first of all, God is the one exercising judgment. God, though, has given judgment to David. And because God has given judgment to David, he says to the nations, kiss the Son. And he's, referring in the context to David, ultimate fulfillment to Christ. Kiss King David, lest King David be angry and you perish in his way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are those who take refuge in the Lord. Ultimately, take refuge in God and repent, or David is going to come and is he going to dash you with a rod of iron. Ultimately, this universal dominion has not come till Christ. Now under Christ, all are now given the option. Either serve God, take refuge in him, or perish in his way. So brethren, what are lessons from Psalm 2? Well, I would recommend as we look at Nice, France, there's a few things we need to remember. Whenever we look at national tragedies like this, and I would venture to say, we were talking about this with a few ladies in the back a few minutes ago, it's not going to be long again before we see another one like this, as unfortunate as it is. Well, the first thing I'd recommend we need to remember is the Lord reigns while the nations rage. There's no telling who all is trying to take over and kill Americans. And as blunt as that is, there are many people that want every last one of us gone. All these nations have raged. They wanted the same thing of David and Israel. They wanted to overtake Israel. They wanted to get rid of David. They wanted to get rid of the people. And ultimately, David says, they can plot, they can rage, they can scheme against me, but God is reigning. Brethren, what do we put our confidence in? Do we put it in the fear of the nations or faith in God? That just as God was the one who reigned, just as God was the one who was victorious, just as God is king, he likewise is going to be the one who will save us. The second recommendation I would give is this. Jesus has now united all nations in him. And because Jesus has now united all nations in him, all should honor the Son. On the day of judgment, Christ himself will have all judgment. He will dash us with a rod of iron, or we will take refuge in him. It's the same image painted on the day of judgment. And the question we have is now, do we find refuge in Jesus, or do we flee from him? Third recommendation, we must submit to the king. And this is what was told to the nations. You either take submission in the king, fear him with trembling, find refuge in him, or perish. If David were here today, I think he would tell us we don't need to fear all the other nations. We don't need to fear their plotting. We don't need to fear their scheming. We need to take refuge in the God of heaven. And while there's evil in this world that I can't even begin to comprehend, God made us. He can save us. And thank God the Lord reigns. Get out your songbooks, please. I recognize that both of my messages today have been about things that are going on in the world today. And I won't do this all the time, but there are just a couple things that I think have been on all of our hearts, and I wanted us to put in a biblical perspective. It's so easy to look at all the nonsense that goes on in the world and get so downcast with it that we forget that God is in heaven. And ultimately, God is the one who provides for us this eternal perspective where we can look at all the wickedness of the world and we can see the true cause of all of it. That Satan and the forces of evil are wanting all of us to give in to sin. They're wanting all of us to give in to wickedness. And Satan is the one who is plotting and scheming and conniving so that all wickedness can occur. And the choice that we have to make is, do we take refuge in God or do we flee from him? I've not talked at all about the plan of salvation this evening or what's needed to come to Jesus, but one message I think rings very true is, just as it's terrifying oftentimes what happens in the world, sin itself and the consequences of it can be just as terrifying. We can get ourselves in a pit to where it seems like we're never able to get out, but God himself, who amongst, while we plot in our lives, God himself reigns and God himself rules. If anyone needs to respond to the Lord's invitation, come forward while we stand and sing.